Hey, podcast fans, this is Chris Webster, founder of the APN, and I just want to thank you for downloading this episode. Please consider becoming a member of the APN if you're not already, and helping us make more great shows and get them out to the world. Head over to arcpodnet.com/members or click the link in the show notes. On to the show.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. I'm going to be interviewed by Chris Webster today, and we're going to talk about indexical animals, the quail and the eagle. Coming up. Don't miss it.
Welcome, everybody, to the Rock Art Podcast. I'm Chris Webster, and if you're hearing my voice, that means it's just Alan and I today. And we're going to talk about something that we've talked about actually for a lot of episodes. This has been mentioned, indexical animals, but we're going to talk about a couple of specific indexical animals on this show. So, Alan, why don't you just start out by telling us what an indexical animal is to get us kicked off again?
So, yeah. It appears that cultures around the world, pre-literate cultures in the main, but also literate cultures, have a very special relationship with animals. This relationship with animals allows them to depict them in their art forms, and also to have them imbibed, sort of ensconced with tremendous meaning. Many, many levels of meaning go into these images of animals. And they can mean many things. And certain animals are especially powerful and are recognized throughout the world as what I call an indexical animal. It's an indexical in the sense that it almost becomes a signature icon, or also sometimes a shamanistic ancestor deity, something that is all-powerful and influential. We think of this sometimes as those large creatures, those horned animals, like a bighorn sheep or a ram or a bull or something along those lines, sometimes a bear.
Yeah.
Other times, these animals are not as ferocious or as, how would you put it, as overpowering or monstrous as we imagine.
Okay.
And so sometimes some of the animals are magical creatures, or creatures that even we might get a chuckle out of or be impressed by, and that they're beautiful, and they tend to have a rather positive meaning, and one that is more in the line of sometimes majestic, but sometimes otherwise related to their habits and their habitat. That's something that I have culled from a famous book by Judith Vander, talking about animals and their relationship to people's minds, their cognitive essence. I always think about the cognitive universe that we sort of put together and try to understand the world. is a term called cosmology, which simply means worldview. And all cultures have a worldview. And when we have also a deity or a theology, a religion of sorts, we sometimes think about things using animal metaphors, animal meanings, animal symbology. And you see this a lot in rock art. And those people that have experienced rock art all over the world, it's one of those joys or one of those magnificent experiences when one sees an animal displayed on a rock art painting. I think back to the earliest rock art with those magnificent caves in Europe and France and otherwise, which has these amazing creatures and these almost photorealistic panels of paintings that are tens of thousands of years old. When those were, of course, discovered, people could not believe that our ancestors were so artistic or able to capture in their imagination and on the stones such realistic and vital images. You've seen them, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. And, you know, depending on where you're at in the world, too, you do see when you're looking, especially at rock art, because that is the oldest and most concrete, so to speak, thing that we have from the prehistoric world. A lot of the other things they may have done, you know, may not stick around. Although you do see stuff in, say, cave environments. There have been things found in Nevada caves, like Lovelock Cave and things like that, where there were duck decoys. And we call them decoys because we're used to seeing them like that. And maybe they were used as decoys, but maybe these ducks were indexical animals. And I just wanted to make the point, and maybe you can talk on this. When we say, you know, well, this is the rock art podcast and we're going to talk about some images in rock art, and you say indexical animals, this isn't unique to rock art. This is unique to the culture or society that we're talking about. This is an animal that is important to them in many ways, and they've depicted that in probably many ways, some of which we can see today, some of which we can't, I would assume.
Yeah, I think that's very important and very significant, Chris, and I'm glad you brought that up, that these are animals, and I know I've mentioned this in the past in one of the podcasts, but the famous French thinker, philosopher, anthropologist coined a phrase where he said, well, these animals were good to eat, but also good to think. and so that was Levi Strauss who said that, famous structural functionalist founder. His ideas were bang on.
Yeah.
When you begin to pierce the veil and think about this, we're dealing with people that had a different mindset. They listened to the world. They were not ruled by technology or the written word, but more by sound, auditory sound, and the visible world, the natural world. And I think that that takes us back into a whole different plane, a whole different mode of existence and a mode of kind of the existential universe of trying to understand rock art. My friend Eve Ewing, who's in her mid-80s, is one of those amazing creatures that watches the rock art and looks and peers and thinks and doesn't glance but looks deeply and studies and restudies the same panels over and over again for what they communicate to her. And eventually they tell her a story or they give her information about what they're trying to convey. And that's part of a story.
Yeah.
It's a way of looking. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of perceiving. When we see rock art, it was in some cases meant to be viewed, and it was evocative. It evoked emotions and sensibilities, and it produced a message that was important to the people.
Okay.
And that message was powerful. It was something that these are what we call outdoor churches. And these were visual shorthand. This was a way of communicating in a prayerful way and letting the deities, the gods, the universe know of what the requests might be or what they need and want and what their yearnings were and what their feelings were and what their stories were and all the above and more.
Okay. So on this episode, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about two specific indexical animals. What is the area, before we get to those animals, what is the area that we're talking about here where these the people and the animals in question would have lived?
Well, the second one is Pan-Americas. It's throughout North America. It's the eagle, and the eagle, of course, must be considered an indexical animal. And throughout the Americas, I would say many, if not all, Native people revered and connected with this primary benefactor, as it was. They saw that it was the largest bird of the air and had certain attributes that were very prestigious and evocative. There was a sense of a connection with the supernatural and with the divine, because, of course, these were birds of the highest realm.
True.
And that's where the gods live, and that's where the deities are, and that's where we want to be if we want to deal with some of these higher order theological questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's the other bird?
The second one is one that you people laugh at, and that's the quail. the little tiny quail that we see and we surprise, and they run out in front of us with their little babies following, and they have those funny little top knots on their heads, and people just laugh and think they're the funniest things this side the Pecos.
That's right.
So, and believe it or not, there's a lot to say and a lot to know about them quail. I've been studying them and thinking about them for, I'd say, nigh on 50 years. So,
wow. Yeah.
Some of the questions have answers, and probably others I'll never know in this side of the ethereal plane. But yeah, I have a few things to say about quail and about those birds of the higher ground, the eagles. And that isn't the band, you guys.
That's right. All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and take a break right there? And then when we come back, we'll spend one segment talking about the eagle, and maybe we'll spend the other segment talking about the quail, because there's a lot to say about both of these. So let's go ahead and do that on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. It's Chris Webster again. If you haven't checked out our new parent website, culturomedia.com, then please do. Culturo is spelled K-U-L-T-U-R-O, and it's where we promote all of our live events. We've got one coming up in November. Check it out over at Culturo when it gets posted. If it's already happened and you're hearing this, then as a member, you can go to your member pages and see the event recording. Our live events are always free, but you have to show up during the event to see it. So that's culturomedia.com for all our live events and more. culturomedia.com. Chris Webster here, founder of the APN and host of several shows. I just wanted to let you know about our membership program and what it offers. Members of the APN get, for just $7.99 a month, or cheaper if you pay for the year, ad-free episodes so you don't have to listen to me on the breaks, membership in our Slack team so you can continue the conversation with hosts and other members, and exclusive access to any of our live event recordings. Live events are always free, but you only get to watch the recording if you're a member. So head over to arcpodnet.com/members for more info and to become a member. Our podcasts are always free, but this is just a little something extra, and it really helps us out. That's arcpodnet.com/members. This is Chris Webster at the APN. I'm also a project manager for several industries. I wouldn't be able to keep on track with really anything if it wasn't for Motion. With Motion, I just say what I need to do, how long I think it'll take, what sort of priority I think it has, and Motion builds my day for me. It'll even build in breaks because, let's be honest, it's hard to remember to stop to eat lunch sometimes. So head over to arcpodnet.com/motion for a free trial and a discount if you sign up. You'll kick back a small amount to the APN if you do. That's arcpodnet.com/motion. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 91. This is segment two, and this is Chris Webster. I'm interviewing Alan, your host usually, but we've just flipped the tables as we do occasionally. And we're talking about indexical animals. And on the last segment, we defined indexical animals, and we talked about the eagle and the quail as the subjects of the next two segments. So let's go ahead and We'll talk about them in size order, if you will, and start with the lowly quail first, the one that makes us all laugh. I don't know if it's the Joker of the animal world or not, but they are pretty funny.
Well, the quail is something that obviously was an obsession with the research group that I'm most acquainted with and associated with. And that's the folks called the COSO, COSO right. meaning fire, and out in Eastern California, where there's the greatest concentration of rock art in the entire Western Hemisphere. They do a lot of depictions mm-hmm. of quail.
Yeah.
And they do them in tiny realms, but also in bigger visages. And one of the things that they seem to have been obsessed with, besides the depictions of those birds themselves, was in adorning their decorated animal human figures with quail plumes.
Okay.
They would have quail plumes all along their headdresses or along their heads, sometimes one or two, sometimes I would say over a dozen different quail plumes on their heads.
Do we see ethnographically evidence of this happening in real life, not just in depictions on rock art? Because the quail, the plume on the top of a quail's head is, I mean, quail aren't big animals, so it would be kind of a small thing. But I could see that graphically, if you were going to depict this in rock art, you might over exaggerate it and make it something bigger on a human figure, right? But do we have anything in the historical record that says, yeah,
you're on the money, Doc. So this is something that was a bit of an epiphany for me. I did not understand until relatively recently what this quail thing was all about. And I said, what the heck is going on here? Why would they depict quail so much? And why would they have these quail plumes on all these creatures, all these, you know, embellished, rather elaborate and heavily designed animal-human figures? Obviously, it had to have some kind of significance and meaning.
Right.
So I looked ethnographically and I said, well, tell me, where does the quail fit in the indigenous people who lived in and about this region in the Western Mojave Desert of Eastern California? And lo and behold, there were some stories. There's a story about this creature called Yahigal amongst the Tobotalaba, which are the far Southern Sierra pinyon pine nut eater people. And this was a creature that was looking to get married, come some kind of coyote creature. And he found a couple of the ladies who he liked and wanted to bed them down. And but they had what was called a vagina dentata.
Okay.
Which meant a toothed female, the reproductive mechanism. So,
right.
And it had teeth. And so
wow.
All of the suitors who tried to bed them down or reproduce or spend the night with these two beautiful ladies ended up dying because they chopped off their genitals. So Coyote got a great idea, and he said, I'm not going to let these two ladies do that. I'm going to use some sort of a protection on my member, and I'm going to use the atlas vertebra of a bighorn sheep, because it's so strong that they won't be able to break it. It'll break those teeth. And so they did that, and he was able to procreate with them, and that's the way the native people started. Now, when they initially came back, this coyote who was trying to bed down these women, he had a bag, right? A special magic bag. And he told them, whatever you do, don't open the magic bag, because all of my little babies will run out. And we need those babies, because I'm responsible for peopling the world. So he went out to hunt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they opened the bag, and out from the bag popped hundreds of quail. Little quail babies popping out of the bag. So yeah. There they were, right? So, okay. And then also, when he came back, he was hunting quail, and he would cook the quail under his armpits. He would be magical, and he was able to cook them there and give them to his female suitors. So there's that story, which is rather difficult to deconstruct or understand. So there's another story, though, that's a little bit easier. And that is, there is a figure, a deity, a spirit, a supernatural being called Yahwera, which is similar to Yahigal. And the name Yahwera, if you deconstruct it, it has to do with death and also a bird-like yelling and also with birds. So Yahwera was a yellow bird, okay? And this yellow bird was responsible for transmogrifying, revitalizing, bringing back the dead animals once they had been killed.
Okay.
Animals don't die, they're immortal, and they go to the animal underworld. And so it's his job to get them back every spring, and they come out via the holes in the rocks or the ponds or the streams or the rivers and any other sort of conduit, some sort of a portal that they can exude themselves. So that particular being, of course, wears a quail feather robe.
Okay.
And this quail feather robe is the magical sort of prestigious robe of a shamanistic ancestor deity figure. And this bird is like the native people. It speaks in their language. And all the animals that are in this underworld also speak the language. And there are deer, and there are bighorn sheep, and there are elk, and other big game animals all living in this underworld land, this very wonderful land that exists under the ground and in the interior of the earth. And an entrance to that particular world can be found on the landscape of the in Eastern California in the Tehachapi Mountains. And there's there's entrances and there's exits. One of the exits is at Little Lake, one's in a cave, etc. So you've got this portal there. And if some of the native people were having a rough time in life, they would be able to visit with Yahwera. He would allow them into his world and help them to rid themselves of their problems. If a hunter was having a failure in hunting, Yahwera could help them. If an individual was sick or depressed or just not with it, he or she could also go into this world. Well, in that particular place, it's called Yahwera Canina, there is a painting, a 4-foot-tall picture of this being, and the being has snakes on both sides of it. So the snakes are there as well. There's a rattlesnake and a gopher snake, and those are the portal protectors, the guardians of the entrance. And when you go in, you pass through a sort of a curtain of water, but you don't get wet. And then you meet Yahwera, and it's a yellow bird that looks like a large sort of some sort of a, you know, not it's like a falcon. Yeah,
okay.
Like a falcon or something like that. Some sort of a beautiful bird wearing this quail feather robe. And if you're a woman, you see a man. And if you're a man, she's a woman. And then because she's a good or he's a good host, they give you food. And it's an endless food. You can either have deer meat or acorn soup or pine nuts or what have you. But it just keeps magically reappearing. And so afterwards, after you get your food, you then go into the place where there's presents. And so the presents is a song. You get a song from Yahwera, and you can pick any song that's on the charts there, and you get your song, and then you get to leave. And he bids you goodbye, and you go out the other way you came in, and you go through another veil of water, and then you find yourself at a totally different place from where you came in before. Hmm. So that's the two prominent stories that exist regarding quail. Well, the quail, this Yahuera, is involved with death and life. And it's sort of written into the actual name Yahuera itself. It also has to do with the sound that they make. The little birds, these quail, have this unusual way of communicating. You can always hear their little chirp, chirp, chirp constantly. Mm-hmm. And they're hidden. Okay. And you can't see them. They want some place that's associated with water, because they got to have water, a little bit of water. But you can never see them. They're hiding. And then if you walk, they explode out of the landscape, and they frighten you. They come out of nowhere, and they're very fecund. They have coveys of dozens and dozens of little baby birds that just continue. Mm-hmm. And I think they have multiple, you know, breeds of these multiple birds, these coveys of quail. So all of that and much more. There's ethnography that the native people used quail plumes to adorn their baskets. And only their best baskets, the most prestigious baskets, the treasure baskets and the birthday baskets, and those that were ritually or religiously most important were adorned with quail plumes. One of those baskets is called the rattlesnake basket. It's a necked jar. It's adorned with quail plumes. And that is the little basket that they make the particular brew to produce an altered state of consciousness and to go into trance using Datura.
Okay.
And so and the name of that basket is embedded with the name of rattlesnake. It's called a rattlesnake basket. There's another basket, and it has rattlesnake images all over it. Now, you wouldn't know they're rattlesnake images. They're diamonds. They're diamonds and triangles in a big, long line.
Of course.
And that is considered to be the rattlesnake basket. Mm-hmm. The other basket that's called the other kind of snake that I had alluded to. What's it called, Consular? The other one that I mentioned. There's the gopher snake. Okay, the gopher snake.
Right,
yes.
Right.
And that snake has more of a rectangular or sort of blocky set of designs on him. And that's that one. So that's that rectangular mm-hmm. basket. It's called the gopher snake basket.
Okay.
So they're giving us some clues that there's something important about these little bitty animals. And also... Mm-hmm. There's something important about those quail plumes, and it has to do with something about life and death and ritual and altered states of consciousness and the supernatural, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all sort of packaged together. Now, when we look at habits and habitat, right, the quail mm-hmm. is one of those liminal creatures. Liminal meaning it lives in kind of two worlds. It can do some flying, but it mainly is a ground bird. So it's kind of on the ground, but in the air a little bit. So it's right. kind of living in two different planes. On top of that, what's really amazing, when a quail bird is attacked, right, by mm-hmm. a predator, the baby birds freeze and look paralyzed and dead. You can pick them up in your hands and they will not move. They are just look like they're paralyzed and dead. And then when they know that the particular fearsome creature is gone, they come back alive. I swear to death.
Wow.
It took me a long time to find that little attribute, but that's what they do. It's one of their means of sort of avoiding death. And the same thing happens with the mom or the dad. If they're in a panic, and a predator is going after them, they feign like they have a broken leg or a broken arm or there's something wrong with them and like they're dying. And the animals won't go after them because they don't want to eat a creature who's sick.
Sure.
Because they know it make them sick. So a couple of those things relate. Here's another one. The Chemehuevi of the Eastern Mojave Desert have a particular hat they wear. And that hat is reserved for excellent hunters or chiefs of the Chemehuevi Indians. And that hat has a concentration of quail plumes right in the center of it. So there's something going on vis-a-vis this animal figure, this quail, and the nature of their religious metaphor for these creatures. I think they have to do with sort of revitalization, resurrection, vitality, life, increase, sort of a prayer for bringing life to take place, sustaining life, and also probably rain and water.
Yeah.
Because the quail, of course, is a water bird that has to have water, moisture, and it's associated with moist and wet places.
All right. Well,
I could go on, but that's the beginning.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I've got a couple questions around that, actually, and then we'll talk about the eagle. But let's go ahead and take a break, and then we'll finish up this discussion, or at least as much as we can, because there's a lot to say on the other side. We'll be back in a minute.
Okay, Doc.
Hey, fans of APN Podcasts. We've got lots of designs over at our T Public store. Every purchase helps out the APN with a few cents back to us. Check out the high-quality t-shirts, stickers, phone cases, coffee mugs, and a lot more. There are lots of colors to choose from in most of those items, and T Public often runs 30% discounts. So check out the store at arcpodnet.com/shop. That's arcpodnet.com/shop, and click on the link. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 91. This is Chris Webster, and I'm interviewing your host, Alan Garfinkel. And we're talking about indexical animals. We talked about quail in the last one. Just a really good background on the importance of the quail. And I'm just wondering, when you were going through that, you know, a lot of your like primary experience, because you've worked there for, you know, 40 plus years, is in the Coso Range in that area. But of course, you know, ranges of these types of ideas extend a long ways out. How much do you know about the quail in other cultures? Because the quail is not unique really to anyone, at least it's not anymore. I don't know what it was a few hundred years ago, if the quail was more localized to maybe that region, or if the quail really was all over North America, because I'm pretty sure the quail's pretty much everywhere at this point. We just saw some the other day, and we saw some up in Canada, and it's just, they're all over the place.
One of the things I studied or learned was in Mesoamerica, in Mexico, the quail was a bird that the commoners used for an offering. They would sacrifice the quail, and that was considered to be part of their offering ritual that they provided to their deities, which surprised me, actually. I don't know why that is that way or what that was all about. The other thing that surprised me, of course, is when you think of Mesoamerica, you think of one of the primary or top-level deities called Quetzalcoatl, right? And Quetzalcoatl is sort of this animal-human figure that is called a feathered serpent.
Right.
And the Quetzal is a plume. It's a green bird with a plume, and it sits on the heads of the snake. Well, that's exactly the same phenomenon that I see in the Cosos with these quail plumes adorning snakes. Now, these Quetzal plumes are enormous compared to the little quail plumes, but conceptually and metaphorically, they seem to have much of the same function to identify the prestigious nature, the leadership nature, the topmost sort of concatenation on these figures. And it's rather interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really think that much about this until I began to be steeped in sort of the mystery of Mesoamerica and sort of seeing some of the parallels mm-hmm. between the Western Great Basin and that kind of look again. So I think birds are some of the key figures that we think about and are mysterious to us. They're quite they are sound, but they're also, you know, figures of the air. So they have a bit of mystery and magic to them.
And speaking of that, let's transition to the eagle, like we were going to talk about, because unlike the quail, which, like you said, is more of a ground bird. I mean, it does fly. It'll do like, you know, short little hops if startled. But the eagle, just like huge, big bird soaring above the sky. I mean, it's an indexical animal now to Americans now. Because yes. It's the symbol of the United States of America.
Yeah. And so it was the symbol of magic and power and mm-hmm. strength to Native Americans all across right. the fruited plain. The eagle became an indexical animal for the Great Basin Paiute Shoshone for a variety of reasons. One reason, of course, is its size, its visual mm-hmm. acuity as a hunter, which is very impressive, and also because it was sort of the lord of the sky, and the sky being, a mysterious place, a connection to that divine, that set of deities, the power and supernatural world. Another thing which was surprising to me, and I've mentioned this before in some of our discussions, is they associate mm-hmm. the eagle with the color white. Now, they're not white birds. They're black birds. They're dark. They're brown. But when they're immature, they have white feathers on their wings and on their breasts mm-hmm. when they're immature. And what the native people would do is they would capture them from the nests and put them in cages and pluck their feathers, the white feathers, because they felt that they were powerful. And when they got too big, they'd let them out. And they'd take to the sky and get back to their natural, you know, landscape. The other association of the eagle, of course, is quite a intimate one with what they call the thunderbird, and not car, but the but the bird of the mythological bird of the air that brings the rain and the thunder and the lightning. And this was supposed to be a bird that was even bigger than the eagle, and just by its flapping of its wings was creating these electrical force and the sound of the thunder and bringing on the rain. And we see that depicted and pecked into the rocks occasionally, not frequently, but occasionally in the Cosos. And then out there near Death Valley, near Saline Valley, in one of the driest places on Earth, there's a site. I haven't been to it, but I've seen many, many photographs of this magnificent place. There's a volcanic layer of pumicite, or some sort of, you know, very easily crafted stone. Mm-hmm. And they have no less than 8 depictions of these thunderbirds that are probably 2, 3, 4 feet tall. And they're all there in their magnificence, right there with their spread wings and very delicately etched. And I'm sure that this related back to the concept of fertility and bringing on the rain, because besides those thunderbirds, there are a lot of vulviform motifs and depictions of female figures with enlarged or embellished female genitalia right there on the rocks in association with those thunderbirds. So if we're looking to live and develop sustainability, we got to have water for food, and we got to have life in us to produce progeny, children that will replace us when we pass. And isn't that kind of the same thing we're dealing with right now? Got to have water, and we got to have people. Right now, there's they call it the demographic winter. In much of the world, they're worried about their numbers not increasing, but decreasing. You're aware of this, right? Over in Europe and Japan, Russia, the numbers of people are not increasing. They're decreasing because as they, even in China, for that matter, when you develop an economy and become industrialized, there's a trend to produce less and less children. Mm-hmm. And with less and less children, ultimately, you're not even reproducing the number of people that you need to replace those who have passed. And that's what's happened.
Right. Anyways. Yeah. And, you know, go back to the eagle and the, the Thunderbird, it made me think, because I grew up in Washington State, specifically Western Washington State. Lots of eagles there. But second, you know, when we learned, you know, in my very rudimentary classes on Washington State history and prehistory, you know, the Native American groups up there, there's totem poles all over the place. In fact, you see totem poles in shopping centers sometimes where they're just, you know, they just have a totem pole up because that's just what you do. And a lot of times at the very top of the totem pole, is an eagle or some other bird of prey, but usually an eagle is depicted. And I think they used like hawk and other things as well. But definitely very, very prominent where I grew up.
The topmost predator, most prestigious, the topmost would be the most holy. When they've changed the laws that non-Indians cannot own or possess eagle feathers. Mm. And it's illegal for non-native people to own any sort of eagle regalia or anything along those lines. It's strictly for Native Americans.
Yeah. You used to see talons, like the talons of an eagle or even a whole paw, like, you know, as a thing that could be sold. But yeah, that was definitely made illegal, but it doesn't mean you can't still find them and people sell them. So you can't even take them off of like roadkill or naturally dead ones because you can't prove that you didn't kill it.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's revered and viewed with tremendous power, magic, respect, prestige. Mm-hmm. And it's white. They like the white. And the white, of course, relates back to that is the color that's associated with the uppermost levels of the religious cosmological map of the universe. That's the topmost layer, and that's the white of the snow, the white of the sun, the white of the clouds and the smoke. Everything that goes up to heavens is in that realm of white. And so that's that cosmological nexus that we see, feel, taste, and sense, and can appeal to us vis-a-vis when they do a rain dance or when the weather shamans are attempting to bring the rain. They do it through smoke. Mm-hmm. And they, because like brings like. And so they will smoke their pipes of native tobacco and blow the smoke, and the smoke goes up, and use feathers because the feathers are lighter than air and they go up to the heavens. So it's an upward glowing realm that is being produced into that white atmosphere, the highest realms of magic, supernatural power, etc. A whole package that sits up there. And it's not that different now cosmologically, because people have a sort of a hankering to go to the tops of mountains, don't they?
Yeah, indeed.
They seem to want to show that they can, I don't know if it's a respect or some sort of an adventure or connection, but they want to feel that they have accomplished something of great prestige and awe by traveling up to the tops of mountains.
Right.
And why is that, Doctor?
You know, because it's there. Isn't that the answer?
That's right. Why did I do it? Because it's there.
Actually, yeah. Well, today, that's what the answer used to be. Now we do it for Instagram so we can get that selfie. That's why we do it.
That's it. We can share it wildly. And because there's satellites, we can have an Instagram picture instantly live feed when we're doing it, right?
That's right. Makes me wonder if, current Native American groups were still doing rock art, if they would just be all selfies, because that's what people like today, you know, just pecking out an image of yourself right there on a rock, but you know, probably not. So
I think that is something that is associated with sort of modern culture, this selfie thing. People are aggrandized and so hyper-centered on themselves.
Yeah.
That's Instagram. That's what else? What's right. All these social networking?
All here's, of them. Pick your flavor.
Yeah. Here's what I ate for breakfast this morning. Here's my lunch. Here's my dinner. Here I am exercising. Here I'm reading my paper and drinking a cup of coffee.
Well, you know, though, it in a larger discussion, though, right? It does seem like nothing's changed, because we want people to validate our life choices and validate our activities and validate who we are as people. But then go look at all the sheer millions of panels of rock art out there. Not all of it is necessarily ritual. Some of it is probably, you know, validation. People saying, hey, look what we've done. Look at this hunt. Look at this thing that we did. Look at this battle. Look at this whatever. You know, people have done that through the centuries in not only rock art to start, but tapestries.
There's an enigmatic element that they call shields in the Kosos. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are mnemonics of individuals who have passed, a treasure, sort of a memory signature.
Yeah. Sure.
And there they are. It's a memory of someone who no longer exists, but it's there on stone. It's an immortality. It's a record of immortality. And it will be there for 100 years, 1,000 years. If it's in a good place, it can be in there almost forever.
Well, some of those people might be immortal, but this podcast certainly isn't. So it's time to end it.
I'm having a blast. I really enjoy working with you. And we always get into these interesting dialogues. So thanks for listening out there in podcast land. See you on the flip flop.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Please consider leaving a review on your favorite podcasting app. You could also consider becoming a member so we can keep content like this free and available to all. Check out pricing and info at archpodnet.com/members. Thanks again, and have a great day.